dahin wegschauen an. Martin, a saint who died and then had a
Face, the final part of Chris Newman's song cycle Format, given its world premiere at the Spitalfields Festival in London in June. The composer himself was joined by Michael Finnessy at the piano. And that ends this edition of Here and Now, dedicated to the music of Chris Newman. It was presented by Ivan Hewitt and produced by David Papp. Next Saturday night, after the last night of the proms, Sarah Moore-Peach will be reporting on the new music that now flourishes in the factories and warehouses of Germany's former home of heavy industry, the Ruhr. That's plus music from the Wittenmusiktage 2010. Here and now, next Saturday night at the later time of 11 o'clock.
Breakfast on Radio 3. Breakfast on Radio 3, bringing music to life. Weekday mornings from 7 till 10 here on BBC Radio 3.
And of course, Radio 3 Breakfast is not just for weekdays. Martin Handley will be here from 7 o'clock tomorrow morning with music for at the early hours of Sunday. That's here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's coming up to 3 minutes past midnight now, and time for the Early Music Show with David McGuinness.
And now we present the first episode of a new radio drama series, The Death of Mary, Queen of Scots. Part 1, The Beginning.
You are Mary, Queen of Scots?
I am.
I don't think the Monty Python team were making any great claims to historical accuracy there, but there was a period in Mary Stuart's life when violence seemed to follow her around. Her closest confidant at court, David Rizzio, was stabbed to death in front of her at the supper table by men she knew, and soon after this her second husband was murdered by rather more technological means in a large explosion, and all this before her 25th birthday. Her own execution, when, as the song says, she got her head chopped off, was still two decades away. I'm here in Stirling, in the great hall of the palace that she knew well. It was the favourite residence of the father she never met, King James V. In fact, I'm sitting on his throne here in an elevated position in the hall, looking at the wonderful view out to the east through the leaded windows. And he spent lavishly on this place, bringing it up to full European palace specification, with the latest architecture, art and crafts. Later in the programme we'll hear some musical discoveries that were recently found hidden in some of the decorations that he commissioned. But James's palace building project was never quite completed. He died, aged only 30, after the Scots' defeat at the shambolic Battle of Solway Moss. His baby daughter Mary became Queen of Scots in December 1542 at the age of just 6 days, and her coronation was here 9 months later. The Kyrie of a three-part mass, probably by Robert Carver, who was active here at Stirling in the 1540s. It wasn't sung there, but it was played on the lute and the bray harp by Rob MacKillop and Bill Taylor. The newly crowned Queen Mary, at 9 months old, had already been promised in marriage to Henry VIII of England's son, Prince Edward. But this treaty was almost immediately broken by Scotland's nobles, who were too sympathetic to Catholicism and to France for Henry's taste. When Mary was moved here to Stirling for her safety from Linlithgow, she was accompanied by 2,500 cavalry, 1,000 infantry, and a baggage train that was a mile long. If you've got a small baby to travel with today, be thankful she's not royal. Henri II in France eventually came to her rescue by proposing that Mary was betrothed to his infant son, the Dauphin François, to unite the kingdoms of France and Scotland. So, aged 5, she set off for France to spend the next 13 years there. She had her own little court with her, including the four Marys, all girls her own age from noble Scottish families, and yes, all called Mary. There was Mary Beaton, Mary Seton, Mary Fleming, and Mary Livingston. And they were later immortalised in a traditional ballad that changes the story a bit, as ballads do. But Mary Beaton is also commemorated with her own tune, which survives in the Rowallan Lute Book from the early 1600s. Two tunes from the Rowallan Lute Book, played there by Ron McFarlane. Queen Mary's father, King James V, was nicknamed King of the Commons for his occasional habit of travelling around the country dressed as a commoner, calling himself the Good Man of Ballingeich. Literally, that means the landlord of the road that goes past the castle here. And although his singing voice was rocky and harsh, he was a keen lute player, and if the royal household's bills are anything to go by, he got through quite a lot of strings. Stirling was his favourite of the royal residences, and he diverted a considerable amount of what had been the church's wealth to enriching first himself and then the palaces. Now, the King and Queen's royal lodgings here, the Great Hall, the Great Kitchens and the Chapel Royal are all being returned to their mid-16th century splendour, and they'll be reopened to the public next year. But I've been let in early to find out about a piece of musical archaeology that came to light in the course of the restoration. I'm joined here in the Chapel Royal at Stirling by the historical harp player Bill Taylor, the musicologist and piper Barnaby Brown, and Matthew Shelley from Historic Scotland. And in front of us, laid out on a table, are two big wooden medallions, which I'm told are two of the Stirling heads. Matthew, can you tell me just what we have here?
Well, they're absolutely beautiful, about a metre wide, carved by hand from oak. These are actually some of 37 replicas of 16th century originals that Historic Scotland has just had made. It took 5 years to make them by a wonderful local craftsman called John Donaldson. Now, we know that the originals of these used to be on the ceiling of the King's Presence Hall in the palace. Now, that was the place where if you had a complaint or were looking for a favour from the king, that was the place that you went to meet him. And so that was the place where you were going to be overawed. Everything in there was designed to intimidate, impress, make you feel the difference between His Majesty and you. And part of that was the ceiling. And so these great roundels, medallions, went on the ceiling, and they feature emperors, kings, queens. There's one of James himself. There's one of his wife, in fact, probably both his wives, his first wife, Princess Madeleine, and then Mary of Guise afterwards. And there were other historic and mythological figures on there, and they would all be staring down at you. So when you went in there, you knew to be very, very careful about what you said.
It's a really three-dimensional object, and staring out of us is what looks very much to me like the spitting image puppet of Margaret Thatcher with the Statue of Liberty hairdo. Now, who is it really?
Well, the theory is that this was Julius Caesar, and in fact the sort of strange spiky crown that you can see behind him is the imperial crown, and that this was him in full battle armour. And so, yes, he was a rather impressive character in his day, but yeah, it is true, he bears an uncanny resemblance to Margaret Thatcher these days, which always catches people.
The two that we've chosen here have got a very specific kind of decoration around the outside. And Barnaby, I wonder if you can help us out with this one here. It's this head number 20. What's going on here?
Well, there are ones and there are zeros and there are what appear to be twos. And this pattern intrigued John Donaldson, the woodcarver employed to reproduce the heads. He couldn't work it out because he was thinking, was the carver here just, had he had one too many? Had he got the pattern wrong? Because the sequence simply doesn't make sense. It bugged him, I think, for over a year until finally, one evening, he was sitting watching something on the internet and it emerged that the Welsh harp players in the 15th century used ones and zeros to write down their music theory, their progressions of ones and zeros that represented a harmonic ground, a harmonic system that allowed them to compose music and to appreciate music. And so he thought, perhaps that's it, and leapt out of the sofa, extremely excited. And a few days later, via his son, who worked in the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama Café Bar, I learnt that this discovery had been made. So it was a fantastic series of events that brought me to the Chapel Royal here to see this fantastic carving from possibly the 1540s. It's one of the high points of wood carving in Europe of its time. And these ones, zeros, and twos, I simply don't believe that the erratic pattern is the mistake of the carver. We don't know it's music, but I think it's too much of a wonderful coincidence that we have this documentary evidence in Wales, the 1480s and the 1570s, where we know musicians wrote down their music theory in ones and zeros. And here we have something similar in Scotland from exactly the same period.
Now, if I can bring in Bill here, because, Bill, I think you were on that programme that John Donaldson was watching that night with your harp. And these days, our entire lives are codified in ones and zeros. We've got used to that now. But how on earth did it work with music?
Well, certainly it is a very odd coincidence to hear, yet again, the importance of the ones and zeros. Today, it's very much in computer technology, on, off, the way computer language works, to see that this notation with ones and zeros could be akin to musical software in the Middle Ages. The two symbols, one and zero, are likened to two different sets of chords. They're contrasting elements which are joined and combined to present a composition. The chords are not specified. When you have a one or a zero in Wales, just simply you have a chord which is more important and a chord which is less important. If we, for instance, take as the most important element an F chord and the less important the neighboring G chord, the movement between the F and the G chords could be employed to create a composition. In the Welsh tradition, the ones and zeros are employed in various ways using a vocabulary of gestures. However, here we have an additional element likened to a Roman numeral 2, which in my interpretation here, I've given a little twiddle, a little decoration, just to set it apart.
That's right.
Exactly. just to acknowledge that that is something a little bit different rather than just thinking of it as a variation on the home chord, as it were.
So you've just produced this music from a sequence of what people thought were decorative markings around this head. Presumably there are lots of other ways to get music from that same material as well. I mean, we don't know that it was a harp player. Is that true, Barnaby?
Well, certainly these ones and zeros, the patterns that you get could be called double tonic. And that term will be familiar to anyone who's been through Scottish music education or has looked at bagpipe music, because practically 90% of all the Highland bagpipe music that exists is, to some degree, double tonic. And I think it may be that these ones and zeros, which you find in music not just from Scotland, but all over the planet, you know, the opposition of two chords is something fairly universal. And probably, you know, the wellsprings of music, I don't think it's necessarily connected. People could come across the alternation of two chords quite separately, be it in Africa or ancient Greece or in Scotland. But we do know from the historical bagpipe music of Scotland that they were very, very specific in their use and their choice of the patterns of ones and zeros. And so all of Pibroch, that's about 36 CDs worth of music, composed between maybe 1550 and 1750, without exception, it all uses a ground. And every single one of those grounds can be reduced very, very easily to a sequence of ones and zeros.
Well, with a setup like that, I've got to ask you to get your pipes out and give us a demonstration.
Gladly. This piece, in fact, comes from one of those manuscripts written down in about 1797. And I'll just sing a couple of the phrases because it makes it much easier to follow for those who are unfamiliar with Pibroch. David, could you just sing me a drone? Because it doesn't work without the drone. So what this piece, this Pibroch, plays about with is the alternation between the notes on the chanter, the melody notes that are in unison or on the fifth, and the notes that are a tone above or a tone below.
Okay, so I'll be your drone. Here we go.
Yororo harren hen, yororo harren hen.
Arvinhin. So there we have the zero and the one. The zero is the tone above, and the one is in unison with the drone. And the pattern that we have here begins on the drone. Harinhen, harinhen. And then it goes away from the drone. And the pattern itself is symmetrical. It's perhaps like Celtic interlace, I don't know, but whether it's about trance or invoking the powers of the other world, but these patterns were very important. You get it in the spell weaving, the prayers and the incantations from the Scottish tradition. And the pattern has its own internal geometry, which is something that you also find in the sequence of the Stirling Head.
Barnaby Brown playing a reproduction of a chanter from the 1690s, and thanks also to Bill Taylor on harp and Matthew Shelley from Historic Scotland at the Chapel Royal in Stirling. When Mary returned to Scotland as a widowed French queen at the age of 18, it wasn't to Stirling, but here to the Palace of Holyrood House and a grey and foggy Edinburgh, where John Knox was in his pomp at the head of the Scottish Reformation. Here, she wasn't immediately welcomed with the Chapel Royal's polyphony, shawms and sackbuts, but with a crowd of 500 or 600 people singing metrical psalms with fiddles. John Knox wasn't a great fan of musical instruments, so he wasn't sure about the fiddles, but he did admire the psalm singers as a company of honest men, and even suggested that Mary had enjoyed the Holy Serenade so much that she willed the psalm to be continued some nichts after with great diligence. The French historian Brantôme, who was also here, wasn't so charmed by the crowd's out-of-tune singing. As he put it, "Eh, quelle musique!" cappella nova with a rather more refined version of what the Edinburgh crowd may have sung to welcome Queen Mary back to Scotland. I wonder if the Chapel Royal Choir ever attempted metrical psalms, and whether John Knox would have approved if they had. He certainly wouldn't have been impressed by the organ. And one thing that he really didn't like was dancing. Mary had been, as he put it, brought up in joyosity, and she didn't intend her partying to stop. As far as Knox was concerned, her courtiers were scoopers, dancers and dalliers with dames, and that to get royal favour, it was more profitable to have been brought up with fiddlers and dancers and to have been exercised in flinging upon a floor and in the rest that thereof follows, than to have been nourished in the company of the godly and exercised in virtue. Now, Knox certainly knew how to turn a phrase, and having built up his ecclesiastical empire over some decades, he was taken aback but clearly impressed with this 18-year-old queen who had her own mind on how her court could behave. I'm in part of Mary's private apartments here in the Palace of Holyrood House, where she might have enjoyed the music of her valet de chambre, who included the bass viol player John Lauder and his father James. James wrote this rather wonderful pavan, which became well known outside Scotland too. My Lord of March Pavan by James Lauder, played by Concerto Caledonia. Queen Mary herself had a good singing voice and played the lute and the virginals, possibly also the harp. And among her musical valet de chambre here in Edinburgh, the string players were mostly Scots and the singers mostly from France. But there was one singer in Mary's chamber, a bass, who wasn't French, although the others called him David Le Chantre. That was the Italian David Rizzio. He soon became her favourite, her private secretary, and her personal assistant, and as his status grew, the Scots eventually came to call him Signor Davy, some of them with more than a hint of sarcasm as they saw him becoming more and more influential. Besides his political and his practical help, he and the other valets joined her at devotions in the Chapel Royal. I wonder if he would have sung this.
Thank you.
See Quis Diligit Me, If You Love Me, by David Peebles. Alan Taverner conducted Capella Nova. Queen Mary's second marriage to her young cousin Lord Darnley began well enough, although the English ambassador wryly noted that after the nuptial mass and three spectacular celebratory masks in the evening, the Queen didn't seem to be in any great hurry to take her new husband upstairs to consummate the union. The young Darnley and David Rizzio spent long hours together on the tennis court at Falkland Palace, but Darnley's jealousy was growing at this Italian's familiarity with his new wife, and at Rizzio's impressive sense of style. Darnley was now the king, after all. Why did he have to share the glory? His first abandoned plan to do away with Rizzio was to engineer an argument on the tennis court about the score, during which a dagger could be drawn. But he and his co-conspirators decided that charging Rizzio with adultery, whether it was true or not, would make for a more convincing crime of passion. The political assassination that followed was carefully staged, with 500 armed men keeping the Palace of Holyrood House secure, while Lord Ruthven and his accomplices fought their way up this rather pokey wee spiral staircase into this room where Mary was at supper. Now, I'm joined, just through this door, by Deborah Clark, who's a curator here in the Palace of Holyrood House. And here we are in the space where the deed was done. Deborah, do tell me, what happened?
Well, Mary, David Rizzio and Mary's attendants were all dining in her private supper room just here. And you can see what a tiny room it is and how crowded it must have been when they're all enjoying their supper.
Well, that was what took me by surprise. I was expecting a big formal dining space. And it's just a little corner off for a larger room.
Well, it's very much her own private space. And I think that's the point that needs to be made. It's just her own invited guests here. And when her husband, Darnley, came up from his own apartments just below, everybody was astonished because he really wouldn't come up without invitation.
The gruesome deed didn't all happen just here in this tiny confined space, did it?
Not at all. Darnley rushed in and grabbed hold of Rizzio, and Rizzio hung onto Mary's skirts. He was terrified. A pistol was held to Mary's stomach. She was 7 months pregnant at the time with the future James VI. They managed to get hold of Rizzio, drag him off Mary's skirts, out into Mary's bedchamber, where they stabbed him 56 times and dragged his body through into the adjoining chamber.
And there is some physical evidence through this door here of where it happened, isn't there?
That's right. His body was dragged right through here and left in this spot here by the window, where a brass plaque commemorates the place where his body lay. But not only that, a dark stain on the floor is supposed to be Rizzio's blood.
Well, I'm standing here by that stain on the floor as the light fades outside over the Edinburgh skyline. And that night, Mary escaped on horseback to Dunbar. Without her here in the palace, the rebellion fizzled out. And she returned to Holyrood House in triumph 5 days later. But now, her marriage and her reign were no cause for dancing. In the sombre months that followed, her Scots viol players might well have accompanied her in this somber setting of the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.
The Scots words of the Lord's Prayer, set to French music by Pierre Cadillac. Custer LaRue was a singer with the Baltimore Consort. The ruthless ambition of Queen Mary's second husband, Lord Darnley, was becoming a problem for more than just Mary. Looking at his portrait here on the wall in Mary's chamber, even at the age of 18, he looks like a cocky so-and-so. And within a year of David Rizzio's murder, it was Darnley's turn for assassination, blown up with gunpowder. Mary's third marriage, soon after, to the Earl of Bothwell, the most likely supplier of that gunpowder, turned the Scots nobles against her, and it was only a matter of weeks before she was forced to abdicate in favour of another infant monarch, her one-year-old son, James VI. She clung on in Scotland for another year, imprisoned at Lochleven, and after one last valiant escape in the Battle of Langside, she fled for England and the mercy of Queen Elizabeth. But Deborah, it didn't quite work out to be mercy, did it?
Not at all. She was kept prisoner by Queen Elizabeth for 19 years in various places. During that time, she did a lot of embroideries, and there's a particularly interesting one here that I thought you might like to see. It shows a ginger cat and a mouse, and the cat has its paw on the mouse's tail. Now, the interesting thing is that the cat is supposed to represent Queen Elizabeth with her paw on Mary, the mouse's tail.
It's a charming piece of work, the fact that it even says in great big capital letters, a cat, along the side. It's got real character.
And it has Mary's cipher on it to show that she actually embroidered it herself.
Well, among Mary's retinue when she was in captivity were the Lauders, musical father and son, and another harpsichord player, William Kinloch, who we know acted as a messenger, carrying not just letters, but weapons. James Lauder, back in Edinburgh, wrote this to his son John, who stayed with the Queen until the very end. And as for your daggers and knives, they are ready to be sent to you. But I only wait for Mr. William Kinloch's coming to London, who is in this country at present. This is William Kinloch's Fantasy. Thank you. John Kitchen played the fantasy by William Kinloch, composer and secret messenger for Mary Queen of Scots in exile. After 19 years of imprisonment, Mary's days of dancing in France and here in the Palace of Holyrood House must have seemed a long way off. Not that she was quick to give up hope of taking the throne once more in Edinburgh or even in London. We still don't know whether the letters were genuine that convicted her of treason for a part in the Babington plot to kill Elizabeth and take the English throne herself. And Elizabeth seems to have had some hesitation in signing Mary's death warrant. But I'd like to leave Mary today with another courtly song, this time a love song in Scots, set in a French style. It's a song of courtly love from a distance. But its opening lines to the Venus that's the object of the writer's affection would have been just as powerful to Mary, thinking of Elizabeth on the throne that had slipped ever further from her grasp. Richt sore oppressed am I with pain's smart. Both night and day makened my woeful moan to Venus Queen, that lady has my hurt, put in so great distress with woe begone. But if that she send remede anon, I list no langer my life till endure, but to the death, bound, careful creature. One of Mary's last requests before her execution was that her servants, her musicians, should be released.
Thank you. Radio 3 Through the Night. Welcome from me, Susan Sharp, if you've just tuned in. An unusual combination of Israeli and Swiss ensembles is performing the music in this morning's concert. The Israeli group is the ensemble Profeti della Quinta, founded in 2003 in the Galilee region of Israel by Elam Rotem, who's also a harpsichordist. The singers and instrumentalists in the group focus on sacred and secular music from the 16th and 17th centuries. Muscadin is the name of the Swiss group, and they got together when they were students at the Schola Cantorum in Basel. Together, they're performing a mixture of sonatas and settings from synagogue services by Salomone Rossi.
Thank you. small.